Here we go.
Blog Talk Radio.
Comes my music.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a bird, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. MJ Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the air.
Good morning, everyone. This is MJ Network. I'm your host, Fran Lewis. MJ stands for my sister, Marcia Joyce, who I miss every day. And this is going to be fun because Henry Swan is back, and so is Goldblatt. Watch out. Henry Swan takes each case to the highest level that he can, even when he roadblocks an obstacle he faces, he and Goldblatt manage to take over. Join in the investigation when necessary, and criminal attorney that never saw it coming. Smart, likable, torn at times, what happens when trust, betrayals, and deceptions come our way, and we must look long and hard to see behind the mist, behind the clouds, and find the clarity of the situation. Once again, author Charles Salzberg has raised the bar, and you want to read this one. Good morning. How you doing?
I'm doing great, Fred. Thanks so much for having me back.
I'm so glad to be that you are back, and my God, I love Henry Swan, but Goldblatt reminds me of me a lot, too, because he just says it the way it is, and he expects you just to do it, which I think is a riot. So how did Swan and Goldblatt meet, and what are their backstories? So, and Goldblatt got disbarred, but really, the guy knows his stuff, doesn't he?
Yes, and, you know, it's an interesting thing you should ask that, Fran, because, you know, a lot of authors will tell you they know everything about their characters, but, and I know a lot. I mean, I have to know a lot about the characters, but when I created, I have a big backstory for Swan. I created Goldblatt. I had very little backstory. I just knew that he was a disbarred lawyer. I didn't know why, and I purposely wanted him to be a little bit of a mysterious character with a mysterious background. So there were allusions that he might have worked for the government, like for the CIA or the FBI. So I purposely kept that open in terms of Goldblatt's backstory, because I can write him better if I don't even know that much about him. So, for instance, in this book, right away we find out that he was married, actually multiple times. Before I started to write the book, I did not know that. I just, the minute I sat down and started writing the first chapter, I knew that the book was going to be a little bit more about Goldblatt than usual and Goldblatt's life. But I had no idea that he'd been married before and how many times he'd been married. So it's a really good question, and I wish I could answer it better, but his background gets revealed to me as I write his character.
Well, that surprised me, too, because I didn't realize he was married so many times, and he's really a hachi-tachi guy. So
and no one knew why. A good-looking guy and, you know, overweight, but somehow he has a way with the women.
Well, some people like people like that. You don't know. My dad was 434 pounds, so he was the cutest guy on this planet, to me anyway. It didn't matter. So they remind me of Felix and Oscar on The Odd Couple, to the two of them. So how do they work together? And how does, I'll tell you, Goldblatt reminds me of my father. How does Goldblatt always get Swan to take on cases that he thinks he should handle, get there out of the ordinary? My dad used to get me to do stuff that my mother wasn't supposed to know, and they were out of the ordinary. So this is cracks me up. So how did he always get him to do it all the time?
Guilt. Because in my mind, the first time Goldblatt appears in one of the Swan books, I think it's in the second, and he's a really quick character. He's just someone that Swan has worked with before, probably when Goldblatt was an actual lawyer. Swan used to do work for lawyers. And I just thought this character really sort of resonates with him. So that's how they met early on in a professional way. And they're part of the development of the case is that Swan is the ego and Goldblatt is the id. And so Swan, there's nothing that Goldblatt won't do, we think. And one of the things he does provide is he finds cases for Swan to work on. And Swan is always sort of on the edge financially. And so when Goldblatt brings him a case, then Swan feels obligated to him to do something like this, which is one of the cases in the book, working for Goldblatt. It's why he can't say goodbye to him, and why he can't say no. And he also admires Goldblatt in some ways, because Goldblatt has these mysterious ways of making things happen. And so there's this kind of, I think that it's a good analogy, the Felix Unger analogy, because two people are very different, but they're connected in some way.
So how come they always meet at a restaurant? Well, he likes food, Goldblatt.
Because Goldblatt loves any excuse for him to be able to eat is he will take. And so he's the one who said, we're going to have these meetings at places to eat, at restaurants. And it's purely so that he can eat.
So what is he wants to take this case. So we meet, she's really a dingbat, this one, Rachel. And when we meet her, we know she's kind of strange and gullible and doesn't quite get it. She's not wrapped too tight on a light bulb that's high. So she meets Madame Sophia. And what research did you learn into mind readers in order to lure people into believing him? I mean, she's convinced that Madame Sophia is right. So how did you decide to have a psychic in there? Because that was different.
Yeah, it was, and it was not accidental. All the Swan books, actually all the books that I write, they start out with a curiosity on my part or an interest in something that I'm going to write about. And I've always been fascinated by psychics and the psychic world and fortune tellers and EFT. So I thought, well, I'm going to write a book with that as one of the plots, as one of the main plots. And so the other thing that I do is when I choose something to write about for a novel, this might be my magazine journalism background, I like to research it. It gives me an excuse to research it. So I was able to research the psychic world a little bit because I was going to write about it. And the other thing is that when I was a kid, there was a guy, I used to hear him on the radio. He was a magician. And his name was the Amazing Randy. His real name was James Randy. And I have a character in this book that's really modeled after the Amazing Randy, and that's the expert that Swan goes to find out about fortune tellers and about psychics. And so that's the reason I wanted to write about them, is so that I could learn more about them. And the other thing, you mentioned the character of Rachel. I know a lot of women like that, and this is not pejorative at all, who are very new agey and are willing to try a lot of different things. And so I wanted to create a character like that. She's not stupid by any means, and she's not gullible in the sense of can be taken about everything, but she's open to the possibility of a spirit world or a psychic world, and so she is flighty and she's all the things that you said, but I think there are a lot of people like this, and I'm not denigrating them. I wanted really to see how their minds work.
Well, she's not the only one. I've met a whole lot of people like that. As a matter of fact, my niece is like that. She believes in the psychic world, and a few other people that I've met, you know, believe in the psychic world also. I mean, really, that's okay.
And they can be intelligent people, Fran. I mean, I have a lot of friends who I really respect, who are more, and often it's women, and I think this is just a theory. I think that women are, generally speaking, more intuitive than men are, and they're more open to this kind of thing than men are, who are very factual. And so it's actually something I think that's quite good about women, is that they are, many of them, open to these things. You know, no matter how ridiculous it might seem, there might be something to some of these things, and that's sort of what I'm working on.
Well, she meets Michael, and she falls hard for this guy. I need to give her the checklist that I use when my sister, you know, would say to me, "You met somebody." I have a checklist to see if he's worthy. So I said it to my nieces too. So she needs a checklist, this one, to see. So she met Michael and fell hard, and we realized that she'll only tell Swan information. But Goldblatt wants to be included. But why would she only tell Swan? She doesn't want to say anything about anything else to him.
Yeah, I think she's. I think when anyone gets taken or think they've gotten taken, Fran, I think their first feeling is embarrassment. How could I be so stupid?
Yeah.
You know, I had a friend who, the first time she was in New York, the first time she came and she moved here, she was walking probably in Times Square or something and saw one of these three-card Monte guys, and she went up and she lost a lot of money to it because...
Mm.
You know, because she was sort of naive about that, and I think that's very common for a lot of people too. Is you know, New Yorkers we're much more cynical than other people, but I think it's really common, and that's what I wanted to get at is and then after it happened, she was embarrassed by it. How could I fall for that?
Yeah.
So I think that is why she doesn't want. He doesn't want Goldblatt around because Goldblatt can be intrusive. She probably doesn't want him there because she's embarrassed that she got taken.
Yeah. She got taken for a lot of money, too. That's horrible.
Yes.
I would think twice before giving somebody that much money for anything, especially a mind reader, anybody. So then he gets roped into another case. And why does he take that? He tells us what happened when he meets Nikki Diamond. I don't like that guy at all. And who is Jenna? Why does he think she might be his alibi for murder?
The other thing that I wanted to deal with, and then I'll address what actually happens in the book. I wanted to deal with the idea of guilt and innocence and punishment. And so what you're alluding to is that Swan is hired by a lawyer, an old friend, a really good lawyer, who's defending a man for murder. And this man is a known hitman. He has killed many people, but he claims that this particular murder he did not commit. And so Swan is hired by this lawyer, Paul Rudder, to find a witness who can alibi this Nikki Diamond, who's a very you're not supposed to like him. He's a despicable person.
I didn't like him at all.
Right, but the quandary, the moral quandary that Swan goes through, that I was dealing with, is okay. Let's say that Diamond is innocent of this particular murder, but he's guilty of so many other murders that he hasn't been punished for. What would be so bad if he was convicted this time for a murder he didn't commit? And that's the whole question that I'm dealing with in this book. And I don't know the answer. When I write these things, I often don't know the answer. That's why I write them, is to find out what I might do. So that's the quandary involved there, is should he tank it and not look for the possible witness, or even if he finds the possible witness, which is the girlfriend of this Nikki Diamonds, should he bring her back? Exonerate him from murder. So that's the thing that's working in this particular case for him.
That's a good question. That's a really $42 million question. You know, should he just go? What the heck? He did it anyway. He deserved to go anyway. So that's hard. So now he finds Madame Sophia. And what is his impression of her? And how does he manage with Goldblatt's help to find it? How do you tell if a psychic is real or phony? I'm reading another book right now. It's called The Perfect Fraud. And the psychic in the book admits that she's a phony. Her mother wasn't, but she is. And she, you know, come. How do you know when somebody's real or fake? I mean, you walk in and you say, "Oh well, you know, you look tired, or you know this or that." How would they really know anything? Unless they,
well,
you know, sort of, I don't know.
Well, the first thing is you don't really know, but my feeling is that anyone who goes to a psychic is predisposed to thinking that the psychic does know things. So right away you're predisposed. So if I'm having a conversation with you, Fran, and I don't know you, but I'm getting to know you, I can probably figure out some things just by things that you've said to me about you. And there are some people very good at reading other people. You know, they have this talent, which is a real talent. And I'm sure that psychics, the successful ones, also have this talent. They may cheat a little bit too. And in the book, I don't want to give it away, but I talk about the way that these psychics can cheat. But another thing is that they're probably very good intuitives. They can tell things about people just from cues that people give off. But I don't know the answer to that question of can they do it or not. I mean, some of them are awfully impressive. This James Randi that I spoke about, the amazing Randi, said that he would give, I think it was $1 million, to anyone who could prove to him that psychically that he couldn't do with magic. He was a magician. So if anyone said to them, well, the big example was Uri Geller, who could supposedly with his mind bend spoons. And Randi showed that he could do the exact same things that Uri Geller could do with magic and not psychic ability. And so that interested me, too. All these things kind of interested me. And I remember growing up as a kid, listening to the radio at night and hearing James Randi. He was usually on a show by John Neville. It was Long John Neville was the host. And he would have these kind of weird people on, and I would listen late at night. And so I've really always been fascinated by this idea of psychic. And I actually was going to do a book with a woman by the name of Pam Coronado. And Pam was a housewife out in California, and suddenly she got this psychic ability to help solve crimes. And she was used by the police in many cases. And she explained to me how she did, how it worked for her. She could actually see crime happening sometimes, and she was very persuasive, frankly. We never wound up reading the book, but I spent some time with her, and I'm still friendly with her, and so and she was right many times for the police doing this, but is it psychic or is it intuitiveness? I don't know the answer.
See, I don't have that kind of a skill, but I could look at a person and tell you if I like them or not in 5 seconds. Very perceptive.
That's right.
It's really bad. It's bad because I can either like you or hate you in 5 seconds.
That's right. You know who else is good about it? Kids are really good about it, and animals. Animals, I think, they can, like a dog or a cat can tell about a and it's just, I don't know what it is. It's an aura they give off, and it's what you're talking about, is you can tell in 5 seconds if you're with someone whether you like them or not.
Yeah, I have a little girl in this building. Her name, I call her Mags. And every morning she's like 1.5, 2 years old, and she goes, "Where my high five?" So she actually, little kids are great. And
dogs are,
I never liked them when I was younger, but my mother-in-law had a dog, Randi. And I was his favorite person because I scratched him the best because I had the best nails. And I missed my dog. So the police wouldn't take this case. And what happens when he questions Rachel again? Why didn't they believe anything about her? The poor thing. Rachel. She's really in a fog.
Right. Well, you have to prove fraud, and the cops just weren't interested. By the way, this was actually based, a lot of the stuff that I write about was is I get from the newspapers. I'll read a case and it'll sort of resonate with me. And there was a case of a woman who did that to someone, and the police did get her, and she was convicted of it. I don't know if he ever got his money back, but it happens all the time. But the police are you know, they're pretty overworked. And to prove that someone's a fraud is not so easy, especially when someone like Rachel, she went in there knowingly and she handed over the money knowingly. So that's why the police wouldn't take a case like this usually. They're very hard to prove.
That's scary. So wait, let me turn this over there. But there are lessons to be learned in trust and thinking that someone can connect with those that are gone. So what lessons can be learned from what happened to Rachel? I mean, Rachel actually, I don't think she's ever going to give up on believing in a psychic. But what lessons can you learn? I mean, you walk into a room and you're not really sure, and people just hand over $25,000 or more? That's crazy.
Well, it is, but a lot of people do it. I'm a naturally skeptical person. But you know, let me ask you this. How about all those people who invested with Bernie Madoff? They were very intelligent.
Brilliant. I know.
You know, and they should have known that if it's too good to be true, it's probably not true. And they were told they could get 20% on their money when everyone else was getting 10%. They wanted to believe. They wanted to believe that Bernie Madoff make them all this money. It's not so different from what we're talking about here.
That's scary. I know people that I won't say who that have invested in the different ventures and find that
right.
They thought that they owned 5% and they own 1%, and then they put in $500,000 and they wind up with no percent because everybody that owns it gets, you know, that has the higher percent gets the money. So
right, and I'm they're not unintelligent people. They're probably smart.
No, they're not. Sometimes people feel that they need money and they figure this is a quick fix and I'm going to get it right away, and they don't realize that they've been taken. Me, on the other hand, I don't do that. No. So what about Jana? Why does Swan seem so protective of her? I want meeting with Nikki Diamond and realize that he's not giving all of it. He's not saying anything. He sort of speaks from two sides of his mouth. So what do we know about loyalty? I don't like this guy at all. He deserves to go down, poor thing.
You know, as we've talked about before, Swan is very conflicted about this particular trying to find this woman. And once he finds her, he also, he likes her and wants to be protective of her. So he's really not sure what to do. He has a responsibility because he's being paid to do a job, and he's also doing it for someone that he likes. He likes the lawyer that he's working for.
Yeah.
And so, but he also likes Jenna, which is the woman, the girlfriend, and he's protective of her. So again, you know, I like to deal with characters that have complicated, you know, minds I like that real characters are ambivalent about a lot of the things that happen to them. And so I think Swan is like that too. Not someone who always knows what the right thing is to do and always does the right thing. He's human.
Well, if he didn't do the wrong thing and if people were just so, you know, oh, this is great, and there were no flaws or no conflicts, it would be boring. Then I would say,
right.
Why am I reading this? Why am I reading this, and what am I doing to myself to torture poor me? Which I just finished something yesterday, and I emailed the people from the blog tour, and I'm saying, why is it that the first two reviews for this book are not going on because people didn't like it? And I don't, you know, if I say I'm going to do something, I'm just going to do it, but I won't write anything negative, but I'm not going to write anything over the top because the book was really not great. Oh, well.
Right. I mean,
it's bad when you get a bad one.
I want to talk about that for a minute because I think what you're doing, what you said, is interesting, Fran. I think there are two ways that you can either be honest and slam the book if you don't like it, or you can do exactly what you do, which is you just don't write about it. And I think in a way, being an author myself, I mean, listen, thick skins. But writing a book is difficult, and even a bad book, writing a bad book is difficult. And I really appreciate the fact that, someone like you, if they didn't like the book, they wouldn't trash it. They just wouldn't say anything about it. I think that's an honorable way to do it myself. And I was a book reviewer, and I was paid to give my opinion. So I had to give my opinion. But in something like this, why bash the writer when you can just ignore the writer? I mean, you know, so I see what you're conundrum is, and I like the way you deal with it, which is you won't write something bad, but you won't write something good that you don't believe in either.
No, I'm just going to write a summary of the book and let them figure it out, because the main character is one person and the police get sort of like trampled on, and I'm saying now this can't possibly really be happening. And the main character of the book is an art expert, and she solves the murder and everything with the landlord of somebody that was killed. And I'm going like, huh? And it was all about the theft of two paintings. And I'm saying like, okay. And the paintings were real. And they're real paintings. And one of them is really in a museum. And I'm saying, oh, my God. And I have to interview this person in November. So I had to come up with questions, too.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not gonna trash the book, but I came up with pretty much based on the research, but not so much on the plot.
Right.
So we've got Goldblatt does surveillance. He's pretty good at that. And he doesn't even know that he snaps an important piece of information. What would someone in Rachel's shoes do with the information she learns? Would she go on bad choices and decisions, or will anyone ever enlighten her to the real world? Because she's like, oh, my God.
Well, it's a good question. I'll throw it back to you. What do you think about people like this? Do they learn their lessons, or do they fall into the same traps? The bigger question is, do people change? And,
no.
No.
They don't.
I don't think they do either. I think that she is who she is, and she is a little gullible, and I think that she might be a little more careful in the next time, but I agree with you. I think she could get caught into another scheme just because that's who she is. She's a trusting person.
You've got to be careful in this world, and she may need to put a stop sign on her and say, Rachel, don't spend your money on nonsense, and she doesn't see it. No, unfortunately, you're right. She's not. So what would a profiler say about Nikki and his personality? If they had a police profiler, what would they call him? Because he's a horrible person. I don't like him.
Probably a sociopath or a psychopath.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. I had lunch the other day with the real Ross Klavan. You know, he's a character in my books. But I had a lunch with real Ross Klavan, and his cousin is a writer by the name of Mark Olshacker. And Mark was the collaborator on the Mindhunter book, which was he collaborated with the FBI profiler. You may have read that book. There's a new one out that Mark just did with the same guy, this FBI profiler.
I didn't get that one. I didn't get that. I got the other one that you guys did. I read that.
Yeah, and I find them really interesting, the profilers. I'm not going to write about one because there's so much out there. And Mark's books are terrific. And was the Netflix, the Mindhunter series. But the other thing is that I'm not interested in serial killers. You've read, I think, all my books, Fran, and you don't. And you know, I don't do murder mysteries. And I don't do many murders, and if there are murders, they usually take place before the book starts or off screen. So, for instance, Devil in the Hole, which is about a man based on a real case of a man who kills his entire family, that crime happens before the book starts, and there's never another murder in the book. And even Second Story Man, there's one murder in it, but it's off stage. You never see the murder happening. And it's kind of you're not even sure who commits the murder. So I'm not really, that's not the kind of writer I am of murder mysteries. So you'll never find me do it. Well, I shouldn't say never. I probably will never do a serial killer book just because I'm not interested in those people, because they're just plain out crazy.
I've got rid of so many of them this past week. I can tell you that they are crazy. I get them all. It's very scary. So why would someone want to help someone like him, and why did Paul take him on? I mean, we know that he's a psychopath, sociopath. We know he's crazy, and yet why did Paul take him on? I like this guy, Paul, by the way.
Yeah, he's based on a real person, someone that I know.
That's even better.
Because it's his job, Fran, and that's another thing that I was really interested in. I was in law school for a year, one of the worst years of my life. And one of the reasons that I quit, there were many reasons that I quit, but one of the reasons was I realized that I couldn't represent someone who I didn't think was a good person or didn't do what they were accused of, they knew they had to be innocent. But the system worked that way. Everyone deserves the best possible representation. So the people who can do it are people like this lawyer, Paul Rudder, is whether he believes the guy is innocent or not, he believes that he's entitled to representation and he's entitled to a fair trial. And so he takes this case for that reason. And lawyers will tell you that, believe it or not, that in order for the case to work, even someone who's guilty deserves representation. However, I think that the lawyer probably has to believe that the client is innocent. In order to give the best representation. And I believe, I'm not an expert about this, so you have to ask lawyers, but I believe a lawyer will never really ask, doesn't want to know if his client or her client actually did the crime. Because they're an officer of the court, and I'm not so sure what they would have to do. I mean, they say there is a lawyer, you know, it's whatever you tell your lawyer is confidential, but a lot of lawyers aren't interested in the reality of whether you're guilty or innocent. They want to make sure that you get a fair trial and that the prosecution does the work of collecting the evidence and, showing it to the jury and winning the case. And so I do like this lawyer, and he is making the case. Guy, even if he didn't commit this particular murder, he's a horrible person. He's a psychopath. He's a sociopath. But to this lawyer, he still deserves representation, and so that's why.
There are some people that have actually have morals and ethics, but there aren't too many in the world that are. And dealing with lawyers, it could be difficult. But before I forget, this is going to be a very controversial show on Thursday. The book is called Confessions of an Innocent Man by David R. Dow, and we're going to talk about his Texas Innocence Network. He works to free people that are on death row, and he's against the death penalty. And the character in the book, it's extremely interesting. They sent me the book. I had no idea I was getting it. It's one of those, where did you come from? The character in the book is arrested. He's wrongly accused. And what he does to those two judges that incarcerated him is scary. On the 10th, we've got Gabriel Vajon, The Naming Game. And on the 12th, somebody we all know and love, Vincent Zandri, The Caregiver's Wife. And on the 17th and on the 19th, I've got two panel shows. The 17th, we've got five people, and we're going to talk about Hollywood and the author, what happens when you give your script, and it should be very interesting. And on the 19th, we're going to talk about strong female characters with Philip Margolin, John Land, Alan Topol, and R.G. Belsky. On the 24th, the author of, it should be interesting, right? Murmur of the Bees, and to end June, because I don't do shows in July, Emily Eternal, She's an Artificial Consciousness. And just to tell everybody, just so you know, a week from yesterday, June 10th, Silent Voices, my new book is coming out. It's going to go live, and I am excited about that. And if you don't know what I write from the point of view of the dead person behind the gravestone that either did something wrong and deserves to be there, or somebody wronged them. So, though guys, it's on Amazon Kindle. You can pre-order it. So
I'm going to order it. I'm going to order it right after we get off the phone.
Thank you. I want to know what you think. And I'm very excited because Vincent Zandri, R.G. Belsky, Alan Topol, John Land all gave me blurbs for my book, and Nancy Allen is reading it. And I can't wait to see what she thinks.
That's a great panel. I mean, I know everyone, but I don't know John Land, although he gave...
Oh, he's great.
Well, he gave my story in Down to the River, which you read, a really good review. He reviewed the book, and he only named three stories in the book. Mine, one by Reed Farrell Coleman, and then another by Bruce DeSilva and Patricia Smith. So I've never met John, but please thank him for me because he gave me a very nice mention.
You have to meet him if you go to the Thriller Fest, because that's why I go, because he invites me every year because he loves me because I'm wonderful. What can I say? As a matter of fact, I just booked a show for him. He's doing the Murder, She Wrote series, so I'm doing a show for him in December. I just booked it yesterday. And Matt Coyle, too, another one. So what happens when Swan meets Sal and Ivan? And what harsh realities does he learn about these men? And they're loyal to Nikki, which is not good for Swan.
Right. I don't want to give too much away.
No, don't.
But I'll just say that Swan's search for the witness, Jenna,
mm-hmm.
takes him down to Alabama, where he thinks she might be. And that was interesting for me because that's one of my favorite places, Fairhope, Alabama, and it's the first time I put it in a book. And it was kind of a thank you to the people of Fairhope because they have a wonderful bookstore there called Page and Palette. And every time I'm down there, Page and Palette does a book signing for me. So I don't want to give away too much of the book.
No.
And the thing is that I've said it before, and I'm not someone who will never say never, but this is probably the last Swan that I'm going to write, at least for a good while, because there are other things I want to write about, and
mm-hmm.
sometimes authors will tell you this. They've taken a character as far as they can go right now, and I don't want to I would only write a Swan if I got like a terrific idea that I could write in any other way. But I don't want to be a spoiler. He does not die at the end of the book. So people don't have to worry about, is it really the end of Swan? But it might be the last that I write, at least for a good while, because I'm working on a new detective novel now. And then I've got to write another novella for the third. There was Triple Shot, there was Three Strikes.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be another one with Tim O'Mara and Ross Clavin and me. And they've actually started on their novellas, and I haven't even written one word of it yet, and I have to edit it. So that's what I have to be working on.
I'm sure I'm going to get it eventually.
Right. I'm also seriously considering a spinoff from Second Story Man because people were so engaged.
Yeah, I love that book.
With Francis Hoyt, the bad guy, that I'm thinking of writing a spinoff just about him. So we'll see. So that's why I'm gonna retire Swan at least for a while. But he might appear in a short story or something. You never.
He needs a girlfriend. Poor guy. No, seriously.
He does.
Maybe Goldblatt. Maybe Goldblatt's got a match for him, and it better not be Rachel. That's for sure.
That could be the next.
Tell us about Freddie Patton and his link to Madame Sophia. How does he know? He sounds like a real person. How does he know, about her? And why is he so helpful?
Well, as I said, he's the one who's sort of based on mm-hmm. James Randi, and this is his business. He's written a book about fake psychics, and this is what he does. So Swan, it was one of my favorite scenes to write, frankly, because Swan goes out to New Jersey to meet up with him. I just found him a really fun character to write. And he's not, even though he's based on the idea of James Randi, he's not based on James Randi because I've never met him. But I don't want to say too much about him, but he's the expert.
Mm-hmm.
that Swan goes to find out about this whole idea of psychics and fortune tellers.
That's scary. So the other thing that was fascinating me was the fact that you came up with these wild chapter titles. How come you came up with chapter titles leading the readers, to like myself, to understand, oh, that's what's going to happen? How did you come up with them? Because that was different.
Yeah, it's a good question. They just pop up in my mind. I did it for the first Swan, and I really liked the idea of having chapter titles that somehow reflected what was going to be in that chapter. And I'm going to tell you something that I've never told anyone, but in the Swan before this one, which was called Swan's Way Out, almost every chapter title has something to do with a particular idol, songwriter, and performer of mine. And if you want, I will divulge it. If you want the reader to try to figure out who that person is, they can.
Mm.
But practically every chapter has an allusion to this particular songwriter, performer of mine, favorite of mine.
That's different, yeah, because I'm saying, like, well, this is easy. Just another friendly night, yeah, in Eastville, okay.
But you know what will happen, Frank? It just happened the other day. Is maybe I'll be listening to a song or something, or a phrase will come to mind, and I'll say, oh, I'm going to write that down because that could be a great chapter title someday.
Yeah.
So,
well, I'll tell you something. I prefer that than this is chapter on Tom, and this is chapter on Ned, and that drives me crazy. And I'm reading a couple, like, you know, each chapter is somebody else's name, and it's, you know, told from two points of view, and I go, like, why me? Why am I doing this? It gets to be old and ridiculous, and a lot of people are doing that. And it's like, oh, God, no, not another one with chapters after person. So what lessons, if anything, did Henry learn from this case? And do you think he's going to seek out Madame Sophia again? I mean, do you think he wants to see her again? I don't know.
My answer is yes. There's something that's very enticing about her. He likes her. Which complicates. So I don't know. If there were ever another Swan, I wouldn't be surprised if he showed up.
That's why I asked her if he's going to have a girlfriend. That was very sneaky of me.
I know.
Because,
you know. there is an attraction between them, and that was purposeful on my part.
See, then you can't retire him so fast because he doesn't want to be retired. Actually, I could see you writing a book just about Goldblatt alone.
Yeah, you know, my friend Reed Coleman, who's a terrific writer, and he had a series, the Mo Prager series, that he finally ended. And I was talking to him about it, and I said, why? And he does what I do, too, which is that in every book, Mo ages. You know, some characters, they never age in all the books. I didn't want to have to write about Mo Prager in a senior citizen's home. That's why I stopped, because he was getting too old to write more about. And I didn't want that to happen with Swan either. I wanted I didn't want to see, like, not that it might not be interesting, because as a matter of fact, I read a very interesting book where Philip Marlowe, the famous Raymond Chandler character, was a character in the book. I think it's called Only to Sleep, and he's 72 years old, and so he's doing this private detecting as a 72-year-old walking around with a cane, and it was a really interesting book. The writer was able to pull it off, I think, but, so that's why sometimes writers just stop, is they've said all they can about the character, or they just don't want to keep aging the character.
Yeah, well, John Land said that last week, because Jessica Fletcher doesn't age in his book, but we just brought her into the 21st century. So she's still in her 50s or early 60s, but she doesn't get older, which is good. And Sheriff Metzger changes a little bit, but now she could use the internet, and now she could use a cell phone, and it's different. And he said a lot of people have been complaining that they wanted her to stay back in Cabot Cove, the old Cabot Cove. I said that would put me to sleep reading it, because it wouldn't be real. because Jessica Fletcher is now, you know, in the 21st century. The books are really good. Everybody's got to read it. Murder in Red is fantastic. Dating for Murder, when she actually goes on a blind date, and she goes on one of those things where they have you sit down, and every 5 minutes somebody comes around. That was hilarious.
The speed dating, yeah.
The speed dating, yeah.
Well, the name of that brand is Jessica Fletcher. Is the same age in all the books. It has to be. You know, that's the point.
Yeah.
She's an elderly woman. And, you know, so either that or you have to write her as a dead person. So, and the other thing that you've hit on that's really interesting and very difficult for them to do is writing with all the new inventions. Everything changed for writers, especially writers of crime, with a cell phone and a smartphone. Because now suddenly, everything is at your fingertips, and you're never looking for a phone booth. You're never looking to make a call. You're always in communication with email, and that changed writing for a lot of us, and made it much more complicated to deal with a world that was so futuristic and had all these new gadgets that everyone takes for granted. So if you write a book and you don't have a cell phone in it, and it takes place now, a reader's going to say, well, why doesn't this guy or this woman have a cell phone? Everyone has a cell phone. So it's something you have to deal with as a writer.
There was an ad in this book that I won't say the name of it that I've just finished, one that I'm not crazy about, and the main character had an ad on her phone that she was able to tell the phone to call a person so that the person could hear that she was in trouble. So I'm saying, like, why did you call your ex-husband? Why didn't you just call the police?
Good point.
And you
Good
have
point.
His phone. Yeah, you have his cell phone. I'm like, are you serious? But it's a great app to have. Yeah, because she was in trouble and she didn't have to turn the phone on. She just talked to it. So if Henry Swan could say, what are his strong suits and his weaknesses? He sounds like a cute little guy that, you know, just people find nice and whatever. But... And Madame Sophia, she sounds cool. I like her, even though she's a swindler, whatever. So what would he say about himself, what his strong suits and his weaknesses? What does he have to work on, poor Henry?
You know, in all the years, I've never been asked that question, and it's a really good question.
Oh, God, sorry.
And, no, and you're catching me having to think about it. I think his strength is that he's very logical, and he... has a very inquisitive mind, and he comes from a background, and I don't make a lot of this, he was an English major in college. I always saw him more as a journalist than a detective. And a journalist looking for a story, I used to do it, is almost like a detective. And you have to be very logical, and you have to think, really, okay, like, how am I going to get, I need this information, how am I going to get it? I mean, now we have Google, but before that, you had to make connections. So I think that's one of his strengths, to make connections.
Well, I agree with you. I'm a reading specialist. I have a reading license in learning disabilities, and I had a professor that taught me when I first took my master's how to look. This is why I see things that nobody else does in a book, they said. He taught me how to look past what the words are and figure out what the author's trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
And I read, there's a book, it's phenomenal. I still have the book, believe it or not, with all my crazy notes from college. It's called Understanding Reading, The Psycholinguistics of Reading by Frank Smith. And it teaches you how to go past what the book is about and look down deeper into what you think the author is saying. And I'll never forget it because I wrote my first term paper on index cards because that's what he wanted it on. And I got picked on the rest of the year for being too smart. Really bad. And
you know
after
who
that, he
to
wouldn't
write?
Let me. It's scary. It's scary.
You know who used to write his books on index cards? Was Vladimir Nabokov. That's how he wrote his book on cards.
I had no choice but to write them on index cards, and I'm going like, how do you do this with the computer? And he said, no, you had to type them. And I got the first one, and he walked into class, and he said, there were like 40 of us, and he said, you're all a bunch of idiots except for three of you. And I'm like, holy God, we're all dumb. And he looked at me, and he said, from now on, I will pick what you're going to do your articles on because you got the perfect score. And I go, oh, God, why did I do that? that was the end of me for the rest of the year. And I got picked on every time we walked through the class. He said, okay, friend, you're going to answer the first question. But I had a knack of figuring out what he was going to ask. But, oh, my God. So why does he allow Goldblatt to take over his life at times and send him down these wild paths? I'm telling you, he reminds me of my father. He's great.
To a certain extent, Goldblatt is inscrutable, even to me. I'm not sure why he does things. As I said, I'm not sure his history is a little murky to me, but that's what made him so fun to write, Fran, is because Swan I knew really well. I knew what Swan would do and what Swan wouldn't do.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that a reader would never say, oh, I don't believe that Swan would ever do. But with Goldblatt, he's such a blank slate that
mm-hmm.
fun character to write because nothing he ever does can surprise you because you don't know what he's capable of. And so, and even Swan is like, it feels that way about Goldblatt. And sometimes he even says in the books, you know, he's even surprising me that he's got this ability or he's got this talent to do something. So that's why it was hard for me to answer your question earlier about Goldblatt's past and his history, because it's a blank slate for me, and that's what makes him so fun. I know certain things about him. I know he's a glutton. He loves him. And
mm-hmm.
I know he's a bit outrageous, and I know that he's a murky past, and that's all I know about him until I put him in a book and he comes alive.
He really does come alive, and I could picture him. I could picture this guy weighing about 350 pounds and sitting and eating pancakes or whatever
right.
and not stopping until he's done and then probably ordering dessert.
That's
all
right.
The things that I don't eat ever. So sad. I know, because my dad would do that, and my mom would make him a big dinner, and then he would say, if I could just have one more piece of this, it would be perfect. I go, like, how many more do you want? I mean, seriously.
That's
I used to crack up. Yeah, I used to crack up. Exactly. So there's one other character. Why does Clavin help with him? Who is he in this story before we ask where we can find out more and what's next? Because I know I'm going to get it. I have to get whatever you write.
Well, see Clavin, to me, is the middle person between Goldblatt and Swan. He's a man of reason. He's very intelligent. He's very realistic. You know, you asked me before about the strengths and weaknesses of Swan, and I didn't really get to the weakness. But the weakness to me of Swan is that he's borderline depressed, and he is a skeptic. He's kind of a darker person because of what happened to his wife. His wife was killed in a freak accident, and he's never really recovered from that. And he has a son who he rarely sees.
Yeah.
Actually, he hasn't seen him in like 15 years. So Clavin is right in the middle of the three of them. It's sort of a triumvirate. And so he's the one, he's the most well-adjusted, and he's the most high-functioning of the three of them. So that's the role that he plays in my Swan series. Are connected. All three of them are connected. And by the way, if no one has, you've read all of them, but Clavin does not like Goldblatt at all. At all.
I know.
So
I really think that you could write a book, you know, about Swan's son coming into play. Because he came into play in one, and the one before this one.
Right.
And I would think that would be a really good continuation. I like that.
And you're right, friend. You never see him in the book, but he's part of the book Way Out. And the reason I put him in there is because people like you were fascinated by him. And they kept saying, see him. Mostly women, by the way.
What is that? Oh, gosh. Where did that come from? I just killed the spider. I'm a brave child. Oh, God. Where did that come from? I just killed a spider. I didn't even realize it was on my wall. Oh, God. That sucks.
You're a crime writer.
So I can't stand it. So what can we learn more about you and your work?
Okay. Well, tonight, for instance, I'm appearing at the Mysterious Bookshop. at 6:30, and I'm going to actually be interviewed by the real life Klavan, Ross Klavan. And there's going to be a tarot card reader there too, who's going to give free tarot card readings to people. And then
I saw that. That got me scared altogether. I said, "Oh my God."
Next Tuesday, I'll be at Book Culture on Columbus Avenue at 7 o'clock, with Reed Farrell Coleman interviewing me, and the same tarot card reader will be there. But people can find me on Facebook or Twitter, or I have a website, charlessalzberg.com, and they can probably find me, walking around the Upper West Side if they want to.
Oh, that is really good. Seriously, but I want to thank you so much. Are you coming to the Thriller Fest this year?
I will be there for at least a day to see people like you. I actually have, on that Saturday, I'm doing a library appearance out in Riverhead, Long Island. But I'll be around Friday. I'll probably come over on Friday. And so
That's when I'm coming.
Good.
I'm coming in the morning. As a matter of fact, I just emailed the Hyatt, and I said, just make sure that you have my early check-in, because last year there was a great panel, and I missed it because of the fact that they didn't have the early check-in, and I got a call during the panel with Catherine Coulter and everything, "Oh, you need to come check in." I go like, what? So I'm hoping that.
Can I give one other quick plug, because it pertains to Dick Belsky, who we both know and who's going to be on your show again soon. Dick is going to be the toastmaster of a conference called Deadly Ink in New Jersey, August 1st and 2nd, and he talked me into giving on Friday, August 2nd, which happens to be my birthday, he talked me into giving a class there on how to write a crime novel. So anyone who goes to Deadly Ink can take that class. It's in the morning on August 2nd, and Dick will be there.
I have to thank Dick, too, because he gave me a blurb for my book.
Yeah. So, he's a great guy. And so he sort
he
of...
He really
wrote,
is, yeah.
But thank you, friend. This is one of my favorite interviews that I did today. That you asked great questions, and I really had fun.
Well, you see, you knew what the book was about. You were worried that I was going to know more.
I'm always worried about that. Thanks again, Fran.
Yeah, you're welcome. Everybody have a great day. It's beautiful outside, and bye.
Go ahead.